Hello, I'm Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with another of my screenside chats for our ACAP members. For those of you who haven't attended these before, screenside chats are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information, mostly about COVID-19, but not always. And I'm hoping that they'll be informative and comfortable and fill a niche not addressed by materials otherwise presented. And they hearken back basically to FDR's fireside chats that got the American public through the Great Depression and World War II. Today, our chats addresses the question of how and when do child and adolescent psychiatrists return to work? How should they see patients in this new phase of the pandemic? I thought it would be useful to speak to an authority from Madrid, Spain, a city in which the COVID death rate is only a little less than New York City's. According to the New York Times yesterday, the death rate there has been 4.5 times higher than a comparable rate at this time before COVID. And for New York City, which is where the area that I'm from, the death rate is almost 6 times higher. Spain is a little bit ahead of us in the evolution of this pandemic, but they've certainly been there and done that. I'm also thrilled that Dr. Celso Arango from Madrid will be chatting with us today. Dr. Arango, who has an MD and PhD, by the way, when you have an MD and PhD, do I say doctor? I always wondered about that. Anyway, Dr. Arango has an MD and PhD. He's the director of the Institute of Psychiatry and Mental Health and the chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the Hospital General Universitario Gregorio Marañón in Madrid. This is a very prestigious university hospital. They have the largest hospital in Spain and the largest ICU in Madrid. They too are overwhelmed with COVID-19. Dr. Arango is an international star. He's on the faculty not only at the University of Madrid, but also King's College London, the University of California, San Francisco, and the University of Maryland. He's coordinating a special paper that will be in Lancet Psychiatry that we'll all be really interested in. 25 psychiatrists from different countries are going to be getting together and talking about how the pandemic will shape psychiatry in the future. So let me start right out and ask you, Dr. Arango, how back to normal are you now? How bad did it get and how back to normal are you now?
Well, how bad it was, and it's a real pleasure to let me start saying that it's a real pleasure to be with you, Dr. Carlson, and with all your members of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry that have been, you know, followed for so many years in your meetings and journal and so on. And it's great that I can share our experience here in Madrid, because as you mentioned, we're a little bit ahead of you since we were hit earlier than the U.S. I have to tell you that everything here was transformed. Everything was changed from, you know, in 24 hours. So we had four cases, and from then we went to 100, and from then we went to thousands. And just to give you an idea, in my hospital that has 1,300 beds, one point in time, there was one day in which we had 1,150 COVID-19 patients. So it was more than 90% of all beds were occupied by patients with COVID. That made us change the whole system, change the whole services in terms of psychiatry. Just to give you an idea, we usually have both in adult and child psychiatry, 6 faculty for the liaison department. So that's 3 psychiatrists, 3 psychologists, the real bad days, we went up to more than 25 faculty working in the liaison psychiatry, working with the patients with COVID-19, working with their families, working with the health workers that really needed our help. So it was a huge transformation. Now we're going back to normality, which is the new normality, which of course is nothing to do with what we used to do 4 months ago. So we have recovered, for instance, the child and adolescent psychiatric beds that we lost at some point in time. We have reopened all the day hospitals, including the adolescent and day hospital. We have started to see again new subjects that come to our clinics face to face. But we continue to do all the checkup and the revisions unless they are, the exceptions in which we need to see the patient face to face through the telematic systems and all these telematic platforms. We continue to have all these safety procedures, and we only one relative can come with the kids, and we call them the day before. We check on the temperature and things that make our life much complicated. So that's how we are right now.
So you mentioned something that I've been struggling with. You said only one person comes with a child. So you don't have both parents come in with the child if they want to?
No, not anymore. Of course, there's always exceptions, and we see patients with, for instance, intellectual disabilities, some conduct problems, patients that we foresee that it's not going to be enough with one of the parents. But that has to be based on, and it has to be discussed before they come through the telephone. What are the reasons for not having only one relative coming with the patient? Actually, it was only this last Monday, so a week ago from now, that we allow relatives to visit the patients that were admitted in our inpatient units. Okay. So for more than 3 months, we have not allowed any visits. And again, there's some exceptions. So if we have a patient with autism, intellectual disability that is admitted, then we also admit the father or mother of that of that patient. But otherwise, with the adolescents, all the visits were forbidden. And we have to realize that Spain is by far the country in the world with the highest percentage of health staff infected in the world. So among everyone who has been infected in Spain, 20% of those infected, I think it's less than 2% in the U.S., are people working at the national health system. That includes, of course, not only physicians, but also nurses and ambulance drivers and so on. So the number of infections among health workers has been huge, and that probably has made that we are now on the other extreme of the safety and very cautious and conservative.
So your response basically is you make decisions on a case-by-case basis in terms of the overall rule. So if somebody needs for some reason or not, and I imagine, yeah, so most of your evaluations or treatments, if it's possible to do it remotely, it can be. But let's talk about that for a minute. What do you think has worked and what hasn't worked? And I realize you're still in the learning stages of this, but you are ahead of us. What would you say, don't do this, or, this is working better than we thought it was? Yeah, we know telemedicine's working better than we thought it was, so that's a given. But what other things have you found worked, and what kinds of things would you say, don't do that?
Right. So I think this is common to any pandemic in the past. When you see it retrospectively, there are always things that you will never do. But it's always the same, yeah, right? So you're always too flexible, always too optimistic, always not taking enough care. I'm talking in terms of infections, right? Hospital infections for both patients, relatives, and the staff. And so we didn't have a clean and a dirty circuits. So we use the same, for instance, same elevator for everyone. We use the same stairs. We use the same, we didn't do PCR to the patients that were before admission. There are many safety procedures that we didn't take into account. And that made that many of our colleagues, many of our patients became infected in the hospital. And that's something that, of course, now we know we're not doing that way. And if it comes back and we have a second wave as it is expected to have in the autumn, then we will be much more conservative than we were in terms of
much better prepared. Yeah,
prepared and protected. We didn't use masks at the very beginning, which something that which will be now completely unthinkable nowadays.
But you know what's interesting about those masks? We didn't either. And, you know, I distinctly remember people saying, ah, don't use masks. The, you know, the virus goes right through the mask. Don't waste your time. And now masks are central to...
Well, masks in Spain are mandatory for everyone, everywhere. So it was first at the hospitals, then it was public transportation. Now you cannot leave your house without a mask, and the fine is 100 euros.
You're fined for people that don't obey, they get a fine.
All right. Yeah. So there were in these last 2 months, there have been 1 million fines in Spain.
Okay.
Based on public. Well, the money comes from the same pocket, so it's not going to help much. So we don't have any Germans or British, right? Tourism that we can charge. So it's all Spanish money from Spaniards. Okay. So something we also we will do differently. I mean, there is a lot of controversy among these. So patients and associations that are related to autism and intellectual disability forced the government to, and this was what Spain has been one of the countries with the most strict confinement for the longer period of time. So we were not allowed to leave our house for work or for anything unless you were a doctor or a policeman, but there were very few exceptions. So the children have been locked down for 2.5 months. So it's not that there were no schools, they were not allowed to leave their houses for 2.5 months. They could not even do sports outside or play or whatever. So these organizations with a very good and positive way of thinking, they thought, well, we cannot do this to children that have intellectual disability or autism, that we know is much more difficult for them, right, to adapt to this new reality and stay at home. But at the same time, they managed to have the government allowing these kids to go out in the streets where no one else was allowed. And again, this was intellectual disability, autism mostly. But what they were not informed, and I believe that information and transparency in information is basic, so the families can, you know, balance pros and cons, is that if they became infected, the prognosis was going to be worse for three different reasons. One is because it's very difficult for the hospitals to, especially in those situations, to take care of these type of patients with intellectual disability and autism. The second one is that they had to be admitted with a relative, and for sure at that time the relative became infected. So that's a new source of infection. And the third time, and this is probably the most politically incorrect to say, is that the ICUs in Spain were completely collapsed. So you mentioned that my hospital was the hospital in Spain with the largest number of ICU beds. That's correct. So we had up to 140. What is the normal number of beds in my hospital for ICU? Is 20. So it's a 600% increase, right, in the number of ICU beds. And despite that, they were completely collapsed. So the intensive care doctors have to choose who had, a bed available. And age, biological age, was not the only criterion. It was life expectancy. Mm-hmm. And we know that for many of these conditions, the life expectancy for anyone with whatever, Down syndrome, autism, idiopathic autism, is 30 years less than the general population. And that was taken into account when they made the decision on who got the beds. So this is something which is, again, very unpolitically correct to mention. That is, it wasn't the equation, right? It's not only how old are you, how many years, old, right? You're going.
It must have been awful.
Right. So it was really awful because all these people with all these rare disorders and Down syndrome and autism, and we even have a 24-year all a patient that had a very severe anorexia nervosa eating disorder that was not allowed to go into the to have an ICU because their life expectancy was very small.
So at this point, what you said, you're, you know, I don't know. I think the old normal is a nice memory. How are you treating those autistic children now? How are they? How are you managing with masks and social distancing and all of those things that we know are important with kids who don't understand, aren't necessarily compliant, are too impulsive, whose families, you know, are not sure how to manage it? How are you dealing with that?
Right, that's an excellent question. Let me tell you first that not everything that came with this pandemic is bad, right? There are some positive things. And I can tell you that many ASD children are doing better. All these high functioning kids that have problems with, you know, really are put under stress with social circumstances, right? School, they tell you that they have been their best months in their lives because they were not forced, right, to have all these interactions that they have to suffer going to school or special rehabilitation programs and so on. And of course, the use of cannabis in adolescents has gone to almost zero, right? They were locked down at home with no possibility to buy anything. and not to mention bullying. You know, bullying has disappeared because, you know, no kids are bullied in Spain. So all schools are closed. And let me tell you that I'm not proud of being of my country where schools will reopen in September. And for the last 2 weeks, we have all bars, restaurants, discos, football, soccer, and bullfighting open. So this is the country where discos open 3 months before schools. But having said that, going to your to your question, yes, of course. Especially the autistic children with intellectual disability and more kind of problems, they were very difficult to handle. In my experience, not as difficult as one would have predicted, and especially at the very beginning of the pandemic, it has to be probably with the allo of, you know, everything's so chaotic, everything's so bad that we feel safe here at home, right? But some of them really did badly, and my impression, although I don't have any evidence for this, is that we're using more psychotropic medication. So it's either a new psychotropic medication or higher doses for some children. And I always say that it doesn't matter probably not to miss two or three sessions if you're an adult with a chronic mental disorder, but. When things go wrong, it's always the same, right? The ones that suffer are the ones that are more disabled. The ones that suffer are those who are more vulnerable. We saw that, you know, that in Spain, all the schools had really adapted rapidly to providing all these education through the different platforms that are available. The children with their virtual teacher asking questions and doing all the homework. Well, that didn't work for kids that were in special education. That didn't work for kids that were receiving all this intensive care, like, you know, children at the age of 2, 3, 4 that were receiving all this intensive care programs for autism or for intellectual disability.
It's hard to do ABA virtually, huh?
Correct. Correct. And we know that for them, there is a therapeutic window, right? That it opens, but it also closes. Yeah. And if this continues for months, we're missing some months that we will never be able to recover. The problem with this economical, social, and health crisis is that I believe is going to accentuate inequalities and inequities, right? Inequities, probably, the word to use here. And those that, for instance, in your country, it's probably not that it will affect more the US and Spain. Those that did not have a private insurance and, you know, private coverage will suffer more. And, you know, it's really devastating to see those images from Las Vegas, right? People leaving.
We actually had, if you're interested in tuning in this past weekend, we had a 2-hour forum dedicated dedicated, in fact, to the cultural and diversity inequities, right, or the inequities that cultural disadvantage puts to children and adolescents and adults. And it's really right, very poignant. And we obviously don't have a solution to it. And I can't imagine that it wouldn't be true for every place. But so you haven't solved that problem. You haven't figured out how you deliver language services to a 3-year-old who needs intensive language services for his autism. But you're also saying that maybe keeping a mask on a hyperactive kid isn't as challenging as I thought it might be.
Right. So we have resumed seeing the patients face to face, and we're doing ADOS, and we restarted the recruitment for clinical trials, and this was 10 days ago. How are we doing that? So we're doing that with rather than using the mask, of course, then you will not be able to do all these semi-structured tests. We're using screens, right? So you can see the face, mm-hmm, and we have been informed that keeping with two screens, keeping 1 meter distance is enough, mm-hmm, and so that's how we are doing it.
So you mentioned the ADOS and so on. What do you do about the materials? I mean, I have a bunch of toys in my office that aren't just for toys. I mean, I use them for different things, and I'm sitting there saying, what do I do? Do I soak them between children? What do I do to keep things clean?
Right. So we have to do that. Well, so the patients are and relatives are instructed that differently to what we used to do before, that we never wanted this to happen. But now we tell them that they have to bring their toys, uh-huh, and there's a maximum or one or two toys. They have, uh-huh, to bring their toys from home. And if there is a kid that doesn't have a toy or they forget, we have some, but they're clean every time they leave. So that, you know, it poses a lot of extra time in everything. Mm-hmm. But most of them are out, and so we were very strict with punctuality, and they receive a lot of information the day before we come. We have we also recorded that information so they can see it on our webpage.
But you said something important in there, that this is much more time intensive. You probably need much more in the way of preparation. Your intake workers or whoever it is that do the phone calling need to spend more time with preparing the people with what it is they need. I know I have an evaluation after you and I finish, and I call the family first, and I make sure they have a private place to talk, and you know that they kind of know what to expect, and you know that's 15 minutes added on to the regular evaluation. That we just need to do. It's part of the new norm.
Right.
So I guess that's.
So we're prioritizing, right, those with more severe conditions, since we have less time, so we have, and this is working quite well with the primary care physicians, so the GPs, the general practitioners, mm-hmm, we have developed and that we started last week with this e-consulting. So we have all these emails back and forth in which before they refer someone to us, we may give some indications on, you know, try this medication or try this advice and don't send this patient because it's not severe enough, right? Mm-hmm. So we are prioritizing the more severe ones for the the psychiatrists, working with the general practitioners on making filters that were not the same as they were 4 months ago.
And you said something about two screens. So the doctor has a screen.
Right.
Who else has a screen?
The patient. The patient has a screen. Yeah.
So they bring their own or you give them?
No.
I mean, those aren't cheap.
No. Well, we give them. And that's another thing that we clean because we reuse them. So yeah, they have to be really clean every time with the patient. Right.
On a personal note, how have your healthcare workers, how have the doctors, nurses, social workers, psychologists, how have they felt coming back to work? Are they, oh, thank God, I was going stir crazy at home, or are they frightened about getting sick because they've managed to dodge the virus up to now? Is there a lot of anxiety, in other words, or are people feeling pretty optimistic?
Right. Oh, It's very variable, but let me tell you that more than 50% of our staff never left the hospital, and they were working here every day. Actually, we always have one attending, one consultant on call, 24 hours in the hospital, plus two residents. So three people are on call. During the 2 months that there was a really bad situation, we had five people, 24 hours a day, seven days a week. And they were working with all the people who were dying in isolation and giving the bad news to the families, bringing them to the hospital, and trying to arrange for the farewell visit and so on. So that means that for social workers, they were continuously here because they had a lot of work to do. Most psychiatrists, not the ones in the community outpatient clinics, that they were working from home, but all the psychologists in the hospital, they were coming here every day, and actually some of them more than ever. So what we have seen in the staff, both the child and adult psychiatry department and the adult department, and all the mental health all the health workers, regardless if they're in the mental health field, is that it was this tension, right, between fear of infection, fear of taking the coronavirus home, people that were living with the elderly parents, and the guilt, the fear and guilty for not providing the care they used to, guilty for becoming infected because they were leaving their colleagues by themselves and not being able to, work with them. And that has created a lot of anxiety, affective symptoms, PTSD, insomnia that we're seeing in our staff. And actually, the people that became infected were sent home, some of them for only 2 weeks, that was the minimum, but some of them for 3-4 weeks. When it was time to come back, we have seen some staff developing anxiety symptoms or panic attacks, right? And then, of course, those who are infected, and we're seeing, and this happens also in children, they have these post-viral syndrome with some symptoms that resemble depression in terms of anhedonia, avolition, and not wanting to become engaged or involved in things that they used to appreciate and like in the past. So that's very common. That's very common. So it's a really difficult differential diagnosis with kind of depression, PTSD, or just physical, right? Physical tiredness.
I think one of the things that has been most awful about this is that we don't have a history to go back to. That this thing is they call it novel, so it's novel. So you don't know when somebody's feeling lethargic or if they're having headaches or if their hands grow hair or whatever the thing happens to be. You don't know if it's part of the natural history of the condition, whether it occurs at 2%, 10%, whether it's going to go away in a week or it's going to go away in a month. You know, you have other viruses that you can say, well, there's a post-viral syndrome, but this one seems to have a more neurotoxic effect to it. Not having something that you can look up and say to somebody, well, the five-year survival of this is 20% or 100% or whatever, that makes it even more, I think, anxiety producing. So one Correct. Final question here, because I think we're sort of running out of time. Where do you see yourselves in your hospital or in Spain? Spain is probably a big thing for you to be responsible for. But where do you see yourself? You said September schools were opening. Where do you see yourselves being in by September?
Oh, who knows? You just mentioned it. You know, it's the uncertainty and the unpredictability what makes this really bad to handle, right? Because we're used to bad news, but at least you know how what's going to happen and the time when it's going to happen. Here, we know nothing, right? We are hearing that in some countries, the South Korea, they have a second wave, and what's going to happen? And summer is coming, and we always hear our colleagues saying, you know, I really need a summer vacation. So if that is the case every year, that's definitely the case this year. Are we going to be able to have it? I don't know. I hope we do. But people need to rest. People really need to rest. People need to have a break. People need to stop thinking about the coronavirus, stop thinking about the risks, stop thinking about, you know, and enjoy life in a different way that being locked down in your house, because otherwise you may be killed by an unknown
etiology. Assassin, yeah.
Right. So all these, you know, fantasies that the kids have. I hope that we can resume schools in September, because that would be the best thing that could happen for children. I mean, all this social lack of activity, you know, the social time that they're going to miss, or they have missed for their entire lives, is something they will never, you know, they will never recover. Again, at the same time, you know, always find always positive things. Many of them have spent. And I know, having living in the U.S. and knowing how, you know, father and mother work, you know, a lot of hours outside home, they have spent as much time as with their parents than ever, right? And that's always positive, right? I mean, I think we should, for the children, we should be able to tell them, this is going to happen. This is what's going to happen in September. Then we may change, but at least for the time being, and for many months, they know that they will be able to go back to schools and play with their peers at the school. And even if it needs to be changed, it's better if they receive information in a way that at least they think that we know is going to happen.
Okay, I have had occasion to think of something that may be relevant here. When I was an intern doing my psychiatric first year psychiatry, I spent 6 months.
That was 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. It was back when God was in knee pants. Anyway, so I was in the psychiatric emergency room, was really busy. We had a 24 hours on, 24 hours off time. It was really, I remember how awful I felt at the time. I had a colleague, Japanese colleague, who was sharing the time with me, and he said, "Gay, you'll look back in this time with some fondness, that there was something positive, there was something," he didn't go on quite that long, but he basically said, there's something good that you're going to find looking at this retrospectively. I dearly hope that we learn something from this, and that you were sort of hinting that we had time together with a family, that there was something, not that we ever want this to happen, that it was really, we could have prevented a lot of it. I won't even go into that, but we do have to find something that we've learned from it to make it, because we're human beings and we need to have that piece of positivity to keep us going. So I'm hoping that in 10 years, we'll look back on this and say, okay, this is the part that was good for this. This is the part that we've learned, and this is the part that was really terrible.
Yeah, I don't think we need to wait 10 years. I think that in 10 weeks or now, already now, you and I have realized that we don't need to travel that much to have really good meetings like this one, right? And you in New York, I in Madrid, and we are having a really, you know, productive meeting without the need that any of us travel for 36 hours and with all the pollution and all that.
I absolutely true, absolutely true. All right. I thank you very much, Dr. Rango, for your time, for your wit, for your insights. And I certainly look forward to the paper that I understand you guys are going to be producing. So thank you very much. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Screenside Chats. And I'm hoping actually at some time in the not too distant future to actually talk about opening schools and what kinds of information we're getting from people around the world that are opening their schools. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.